Welcome to the New Mind Creator Podcast with your host, Maurice, the New Mind Creator. Today, I will be interviewing Kirby Ingles. Make sure to hit the subscribe button so that you'll receive alerts when new episodes are available each week on Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. So how does your body feel and your mind, your state of mind, after running such a long distance?
Yeah, that's a great question, Maurice, because actually you wouldn't believe how good that you do feel. I mean, the worst part of it is actually during the race. Now, don't get me wrong. If you prepare your body, you know, and that's not training like a professional athlete, but that's like, you know, making the effort to consistently, you know, run and train and, you know, you kind of know your body and how you fuel it. Because there's a little bit of science and nutrition to that. It's about managing yourself during the course of those 31 to 50 miles or over the course of those 3 days that I was at. You know, you manage your injuries, you manage your blisters. It's all about management at that point. And it's taking things slow, one step at a time, not trying to think about the finish line, but think, okay, how do I get to the next aid station? How do I get through the next mile? And just walking yourself through it slowly and methodically. Also having a little bit of a strategy ahead of yourself. But when you get done, you just feel this euphoric, you know, I have done it. I have finished the race. I have won the battle today. You feel good about yourself and you feel your body really doesn't feel that bad. I mean, you're hungry, you're tired, you're exhausted, but it's a really, really good feeling. And it's almost addicting.
So it's the way you describe it, it sounds like the same feeling after a workout, either in the gym or playing basketball, whatever, a strenuous workout, and you sit down afterwards and that euphoric feeling that you have, it sounds like.
Yeah, very much so, you know, and it's, I think it's even greater because when you think about what you've just accomplished, like when I tell most people that I ultra run, they're like, are you crazy? And it's like, no, you can do this. And they let their mindset get in the way of allowing themselves to achieve these great feats. And I'm like, and I tell them, I'm like, look, I had two herniated discs in my neck and two in my lower back. I overcame both those injuries and I'm ultra running now. And my doctors are very pleased with how well I've overcome those injuries and where I've come at this point. And I'm like, you set your mind to it. You can do anything you possibly want. I've personally proven that to myself. And that's why I go out there every single day to do it, is because it pushes me and allows me to accomplish these great things, you know. And one of the things on my bucket list is to run 100 miles at some point. That kind of tells you where I'm going with this.
Well, you already close. You did 99, so yeah. I think you can hit that 100 mark. Wow. Did anyone introduce you into ultra running? Or,
you know, I happened to run across it by chance. So initially, after I hurt my back, you know, when I told you it was a couple herniated discs in my neck, I got to a point in my life where I was just constantly miserable in pain. And that was, the surgeon had basically told me, he said, if you don't quit what you're doing, you, by the time you're 70 years old, you're going to be in a wheelchair. And that scared me. But that also ignited a fire inside of me. And I was like, you know what, if I'm going to be in a wheelchair by the time I'm 70, and I was in the Army at this point in time, I'm going to go out and I'm just going to nail my bucket list down and get everything in life that I want to do now. Because when I get to that point where I can't walk anymore, I don't want any regrets. So I went out there and I started looking at different options. And as I got more active, I started feeling better. And one of the things that I wanted to do was I wanted to run some races, like a 5K. I wanted to get up to a marathon. And I was like, okay, well, let me start with a 5K. So I looked up a 5K the following week, and I couldn't find one that weekend. And there was a 10K. And so I was like, okay, well, that's about 6.2 miles. I ran 4 miles in the Army. I could probably do that and just, you know, grind it out for the last 2 miles. And I was surprised that after the first 10K, I actually finished third in my age group. And I'm like, and I'm injured and I'm hurt. And I'm like, wait a minute, there's something here. And so I ended up running a circuit in Kansas City. It's an organization called MARTS, the Mid-American Racing Association. And I actually won first place in my age group for the season. And they had this end of end of year ceremony where they give out the trophies, and they did it in a conjunction with a group called the Trail Nerds. I hadn't heard of them before. So I got there, and all these people, they actually run trails. So I started doing my research. And what I found was if you run trails, it's actually a lot better for your body. And it actually strengthens your ligaments and tendons a lot better than running on the road. It takes a little bit of the pounding out because of, you know, you can run on different types of surfaces. And I realized that it was much better for my core and my back. And it was a better workout for me. And once I started running trails, I just really started becoming addicted to the ultra run, because the ultra running community is embedded into the trail running community.
That sounds good. I've heard of that, taking the pounding out of the cement and asphalt that people often run on. The same with people. I know athletes who train, who prefer training at the beach where the sand, and that takes a lot of the pounding on the joints because it, is softer, and it causes those ligaments, like you said, to be strengthened as well. So that's a real good thing to hear. So you are in leadership. How long were you in the military?
23 years.
Wow. Well, thank you for your service. We definitely needed all 23, I'm sure.
Well, thank you, Maurice, because I understand that you're a Navy veteran yourself, right?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. Yeah, well, thank you. So how long has it been since you have been in helping people with leadership across the world?
You know, the leadership really started when I was in the Army. And when it was, I don't know, when I was a sergeant first class, which is an E7, which is almost a senior NCO at that point, really leadership really began to take on a whole new role. Because as you may or may not know, when you're in those mid-grade NCO levels, it's really about just doing what I tell you to do and execute. But then once you start to get towards, you know, the senior ranks, it becomes more of coaching, mentoring, and developing younger people. And that's really when it really became prominent in my life. And when I actually went to Liberty University to get my degree in counseling, my master's, there was a track on leadership coaching. And so I went ahead and started working on that, and also health and wellness, because obviously I was an ultra runner. Health and wellness and mindset was very important to me. And as I started getting involved in that, and I saw the different types of leadership, and, you know, I just kind of fell in love with the part where we inspire people, we help people grow and develop, and really trying to help people become their best selves ever.
So what types of leadership are there?
Well, there, you know, in the military, they look at three different levels of leadership. There's the direct, there's the strategic, and then there's the, it slips my mind here off the top of my head, direct, strategic, and, oh man, it slips my mind. But, you know, there's other things like there's servant leadership, there's purpose to impact leadership, and there's just different varying types, you know, and it's all over the place. There's spiritual leadership. There's organizational leadership. There's organizational development leadership. It's all over the board. So there's like leadership is really just a broad topic, right? And then there's a niche inside of, you can just niche down probably two or three levels in leadership.
Gotcha. So and within a workplace, is it more important to focus on the type of leadership, like a direct or strategic, or on an individualistic realm for helping lead people effectively?
Well, I think that it really depends on your role as in the organization. So, you know, a CEO is more going to be a visionary or a pioneer, and depending on the type of company it is. There's organizational development managers, and they're more focused on the development of the organization. So you're all going to play a different role. But I think when it comes to everybody, every single person, I think leaders have to understand their purpose. And there, you can have what we sometimes call, and what I work on in my coaching practice at KirbyEngels.com, is that we develop leadership purpose statements. And it's who I am, why I'm here, and what I'm to help, you know, to do in the world, and what kind of impact I'm going to have.
So once you answer those questions, then you are able to be more clear in the type of leader, I guess, you can be.
Yeah, your style, how you're going to interact with people, what you're going to try and pull out of people. You know, I think the best leaders I've ever met out there and the ones that I've experienced, because I even worked with some of the Army's best. So I actually had an opportunity to spend 4 years working with the United States Army's Old Guard, which is the president or escort to the president of the United States. And you don't get selected for that unless you're in the top 10%. And when I work with them, I got a lot of leaders pouring into me. And I think that's, you know, one of the great things about leadership is leaders like to pour into people, but they also know how to pull things out of people. They know how to pull your strength out of you so that you see them. And they also know how to pull a lot of other things out there. That way you can kind of wrap your mind around it and you get any of those light bulb or aha moments. And then you be start to, you know, shine as the person that you're kind of designed to be.
So what's the best way for a leader to handle a person who doesn't really, who's not really motivated to follow the vision?
So that would, for me, that would be, and you said follow the vision, is that correct?
Follow the vision, or, you know, what the company is trying to do. They just not motivated.
Yeah, that's an interesting, I actually recently wrote about that a little bit. And it really, it's the leader getting buy-in from the individual, and you have to build trust first, right? And so without trust, you have nothing. And John Maxwell said that, he said that years ago, and it always resonated with me, because trust is the currency of leadership. If you don't have trust, it's going to be really hard for people to follow you, and it's going to become a dictatorship, and you know what kind of environment or culture that's going to develop. But once you build that trust, then you can really sit down and have that conversation. You can say, hey, look, you know, you might not agree with the direction that the organization is going or what they're doing. However, you have to realize what your role is. And that's for you, you know, and you have to follow the leadership's direction. And I've never always agreed with the vision of the organization. However, I still had to show up. I still had to do my job, and I still had to play my part because I knew that at the end of the day, and this is what a leader has to be able to do is communicate with the end of the person and get them to realize is that you're playing a small part to a bigger picture. And without you, you're really missing a piece of the puzzle. And so you really have to kind of almost pin it back on them and show them how valuable they are to the bigger picture.
Great. I think this is going to be really helpful for people hearing it. So how about handling a cantankerous employee, someone who is quarrelsome and possibly could try to get someone else or other people into negativity?
Yeah, and I think the direct approach is really the best way to do that. And it's usually if the employees or the members of the organization can do it themselves, that's usually best. If that's, you know, it's like, hey, you know, that's kind of inappropriate, or, you know, you kind of sound like a Debbie Downer or something like that. You know, if they can do it themselves, that's perfect. And you can empower your people to kind of handle that. But when leadership has to get involved, it's usually almost too late, because usually that's when people have already started talking. People have already started moving away from that person. Sides have been picked. And so it's really important for a leader to have that direct approach with that. And you know, it's times where you really have to kind of boil it down, right? So if you know anything about boiling things down, you get basically down to the core substance or the core ingredient, boil things down. And you have to find out why they are the way they are, because they've probably had a bad experience themselves. And it's usually I know it's sometimes cliche, but hurt people have been hurt before. And that's how they react. And so they try to hurt other people. And so you really have to try and change that behavior, and you have to get at it. And then at the end of the day, if you know, you have to understand that this is an organization and they have to move forward, and sometimes they have to move forward without you, and you may have to find some other employment. So leaders can't be afraid to let people go either. They have to do what's in the best interest of the individual and the organization. And sometimes the best interest of the individual is to let them go. So it's really a tough situation for a leader to be in, but they just need to have a clear head about the direction that they're going to go and give them the opportunity to make a difference. Because I love the people that are challenged and working with them and helping them overcome those challenges. And that's when I was in the Army, I was always known for taking on the people that nobody else wanted because I felt they deserved an opportunity and they could redeem themselves. So
what gave you the confidence to want to even take on that challenge? Because oftentimes people become frustrated when others are not doing the things they are supposed to do continually. So what gave you the confidence that you said, okay, I see this person, I think they deserve another chance. And, you know, what can I do to help them overcome? What gave you that confidence?
Well, I always like a challenge. So as an ultra runner, obviously that's in my blood. But you know, the confidence really did come from it was me. It was my personal experiences, and I had thought that I had maybe one or two bad leaders in my personal experience. And sometimes I thought to myself, well, the only bad employees are bad employees with bad leaders. And sometimes that's true and sometimes it's not. But in some cases that I thought maybe that was the case. Maybe they just didn't have great leadership and they didn't have great mentorship or coaching going, you know, through the system and to where they're at now. So that's the approach that I took. And I would sit them down and I knew up front, you know, what the situation was. So I would just tell them, I would say, hey, man, if this is an opportunity for you to redeem yourself, you know, and I would put it out on the table and basically let them know up front what the situation was and that I was there to help them and I was there to support them as much as I could. But this was a second chance and it was an opportunity for them to rise above. And that's how we kind of started that approach. And usually I would say generally 90% of people took it very, very well.
Wow, that's really good. So I know you help men who are struggling and you help them who desire, those men who desire meaningful life, and you focus on a few things. So I would like to, you know, have you expound a little on those three things. So I know build a foundation that enables a mission-driven purpose. Could you expound a little about that?
Yeah, so building a foundation is really getting at the heart of why we do what we do. And it's understanding your values and your strengths. And so the idea is to build a foundation that you can build a house upon and a foundation that any storm can withstand. So life's going to throw storms at us and you want to have a solid foundation. And that's really understanding your values and what you hold true and understanding what your strengths are, the things that are going to help you thrive as an individual and also be inspiring as a leader. And really just knowing those strengths and values. Then we kind of move on to having a strategic vision and, you know, growing into that person that you want to become and having a mission statement, which is something that kind of gets you up every morning. It's something that you serve. It also helps you keep very, very clear on what your objectives are. So that way, you know, your left and right limits. And the way I tell people is the way we establish our mission statements is that it's just like any other organization. And if you've been in the military, you understand what I'm saying. When you have left and right limits or sectors of fire, because when you're on the range, you know, you know, you don't shoot outside of this area or outside of this area. And the area in front of you is all for your, you know, taking. And if, you know, another way to explain that, if you're not in the military is if you're at a bowling alley, if you go to the right too far, you're going to hit the gutter. If you go to the left too far, you're in the gutter. So you have this very clear, you know, direction, and anything outside of, you know, those is a no. And anything within those, you know, that area is a yes. And so you've really, really have a very, very intentional direction moving forward, and your mission statement can really establish that, and it gives you your who, what, when, where, why, how, and your big so what. And then, you know, finally, you know, we established some goals that really progressively get there. And then, and at the end, you know, it's the build, grow, and then finally, the create, and you create an impact, right? Which revolutionizes the way you lead. And that's really, after we've done all that internal work, we focus outwardly and we focus on serving others in a way that, will resonate across the community that you're in. However you want to describe that community. I know people have different levels of community and different descriptions of what community is. For me, it's really exciting when I get clients that like want to work with, or have that impact, leave that footprint or fingerprint for the next two or three generations. One of my good mentors instilled that into me. And he always talked about how America used to be, you know, on fire, you know, and we used to have all these three and fourth generation businesses, and we don't have as much anymore because the founders, you know, or the people that are in business now have lost sight of the founder's vision. And his idea was just to, you know, help people just become atomic, you know, or nuclear. And that's his idea. And when I started thinking about that, and I started reflecting on my own personal history of my family and the pioneers that came over to this country in the 1747 and established a farm in Blacksburg, Virginia, and it's still sitting there today in the family name, and how they pioneer across the mountains and into the West to where we're at now, and everything that happened between now and then, you know, that really kind of resonated with me a lot. And I was like, okay, well, how can I inspire and revolutionize the way I live that will impact the next three or four generations of my family, like they impacted me, and help them, you know, go from lukewarm to nuclear and just have a passion and purpose and just be on fire.
So I was going to ask about that. Because everything that, I guess, a passion that you are having right now that you're exhibiting and sharing with the world, that passion, everything began somewhere. So I know your family, you know, you trace it to the 1700s, but where did your personal journey begin? And how did your family, who was your greatest mentor when you were a kid?
Well, my greatest mentor is my grandfather. And that's a pretty interesting story. You know, most kids will say that they'll cite a baseball player or an astronaut or somebody else as their hero. But I never had those. Superman wasn't my hero. Green Lantern wasn't my hero. My grandfather was my hero. And I never really quite understood why I looked up to him so much until I really understood the story as an adult. So, my mother had me when I was 18 years old and she was a single parent. And this is, you know, 40 years ago or so. And it was a hard time for single parents back then. She was pretty much disowned from her family at the point in time. And nobody was talking to her because of what had happened. And on the day that I was born, my grandfather actually showed up to the hospital to support her and me. And he was that male mentor figure in my life the entire time. Now, he didn't really say a whole lot to me, but he led by example. He showed me how he loved his wife and how to conduct himself, you know, how to work hard, how to be an asset to the community to help your neighbors out and things like that. And so he just was a really, really good guy that lived very humble life. You know, he didn't have a lot of money. He struggled, you know, they saved all year just to buy grandkids Christmas gifts and stuff like that. But he was one of the happiest men that I'd ever seen, despite, you know, his poverty and his struggles his entire life. And he would give anybody the shirt off his back. And I was really, really inspired by that growing up. And he just had this bigger than life attitude. And he was just always seemed happy and fun and playing on the ground and just enjoying the people in his life and his family. And so that really resonated with me. And I wanted to have a family of my own. So most people were talking about, oh, I want to go be the CEO of this company, or I want to be an astronaut or play in the Major League Baseballs. I just wanted to have a family like my grandfather's.
Well, hearing that story reminds me of one when I was growing up. My great uncle, he was the dominant male figure. And I didn't realize how much of an impact he had on my life because not so much directly. I mean, he didn't like really talk to me a lot and share a lot of stories, but just through observation, it was very impactful. And I found myself talking about things that he would talk about. I think he was one of the wisest men I've ever met in my life. I mean, just extremely insightful about life itself. And he told a lot of things through stories. So just having that person, even that you can touch, is really impactful to be a hero. Even I didn't get a chance to tell him he was a hero because I didn't realize it at the time. So the things we do to reach out in the community and help people, you may never get the response through words because the person who you're impacting may not even realize it at the time.
Oh yeah, definitely. I 100% agree. And that's the way he was for me. He completely impacted my life in a very, very indirect way. And not as direct as some people had impacted my life during that time frame. So as I was growing up, you know, because it wasn't easy for me to grow up. I mean, I had three different stepdads growing up. I never knew who my biological father was. And, you know, different people in different moments of my life stepped in, and they may have only been a 5 or 10 minute moment, but they were very direct and very impactful. And as I look back, I'm very grateful for those. But I would say his indirect impact over a long period of time probably had more influence on me than I realize now. And I'm sure once I get to his age, you know, when he left this world, I will have really understood the complexity of, you know, his impact.
What type of kid were you when you were growing up?
Well, I was a latchkey kid. I ran around. So my mother was, for the most part, like I said, she was married three different times over a period of 20 years. And so I ended up running around with my cousin, who was about 3 years older than me. And as long as, you know, in a small community of 7,000 people, I was with my older cousin, everybody was kind of okay with that. But they knew we would get into trouble from time to time. However, they probably turned a blind eye to a lot of the stuff that we did do. I mean, I did get involved in a lot of things I shouldn't have, like drugs and alcohol growing up, despite, you know, the influences in my life. But, you know, I was left unattended to. My mother had two children that were 12 and 14 years younger than me with my second stepfather. And I had a younger sister that was 2 years younger than I was. And so for me, if I wasn't at home, you know, I wasn't really engaged with them, and I enjoyed my time with the older boys because I really didn't have an older man in my life to kind of mentor me to hang around with. I didn't have that father figure, that healthy supportive figure. So I looked to older boys for that resource, and that's where I found it. And that's who I wanted to be around. And if I wasn't home, I wasn't around babies. So at 12 and 14 years old, I'd prefer to be hanging out with, you know, boys 2 or 3 years older than me than at a home, changing diapers and helping my mom.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's how some people get into gangs as well. Just wanting to be a part of something and accept it, you know. So definitely hearing that triggers that within me for sure. So when did you realize that you were a leader? You had these leadership skills and you just had a desire to help leaders.
You know, I would say that was probably about, I want to say about 10 or 15 years ago. I don't think it really resonated with me in a specific moment, but I think over a gradual period of time, you know, like I said earlier about being the sergeant first class and running, you know, my own HR sections and developing young people. And it wasn't, like I said, you know, I got into the old guard and I had some, really phenomenal leaders that started imparting onto me and really starting to have those conversations. One of them would be, his name is Dwayne Blackman, and he really had a lot of high intellectual leadership conversations with me. And it was more about my personal development as a leader. And we kind of talked a little bit about legacy, the impact that we would have, using the minimum force possible to get the maximum results, just conversations like that. And just going through the day-to-day stuff that would go on in the organization and how to improve it, as well as, you know, benefit the people that were serving. And that was really, really important to me. And those conversations were phenomenal. And I think, you know, within a couple years after that, you know, being able to kind of reflect back on the type of leadership that was around me and the type of leaders that I had served with over the course of time, I really kind of started developing my own leadership styles and abilities from picking out the best aspects of the leaders that I had served with. And it really probably turned up. So after, I would say after I did that job, I worked in the Inspector General's office for a couple of years, and I also worked with victims of sexual assault. And I had a lot of reflection time during that time period. And it was through that reflection time that I realized that we need more leaders. We need more people to stand up, you know, and we also need more people to take care of other people. And we need to change the face of leadership, kind of revolutionize a little bit to where it's more outward focused rather than a leader being seen as a person in a particular position or with a particular title.
So could you talk a little more about the outward focused, but like revolutionizing what a leader is?
Yeah, for me, the outward focus is focusing on the success of others and the potential of other people. When you get down to it, it's focusing on, you know, making everything mutual benefit or a win-win situation. And that's an idea that I took from Stephen Covey. In The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, and I also believe Smart Trust, talks about win-win situations. And I think that's what's really, really missing is everybody feels like they have to compromise. And you don't really have to compromise. And what you do is if you search for the win-win, then everybody walks away happy and they're excited about what just occurred. When you compromise, everybody kind of feels like they lose. And so it's trying to serve, you know, others in a way that where they feel like they've won, and you leave them feeling better as they walk away than what they would have if you would have just compromised.
Right. So I know you're a speaker as well. Have you always felt comfortable speaking?
Actually, no. Speaking has never been comfortable. There's a pretty good story with that. Is when I was, where was it I was at when I, oh yeah, I was in Washington, D.C. I was living out there in Falls Church, Virginia. And I was thinking about leaving the military at about 16 years into it. And I was just curious. And so I started doing some job searching and going to some job fairs. And there was this church that had this monthly, or every 2 weeks, they would have this job seminar. And it was, they would consistently do it. And one of the things that they offered when you would come every 2 weeks is there's an opportunity to join a Toastmasters club designated and designed around, you know, speaking skills, interviewing processes, and things like that, and being able to speak off the cuff, you know, impromptu speaking, really, and developing that creative thinking, being able to think off your feet. And I walked by the place a couple times and the door and peered in, and I was like, I made an excuse. I was like, nah, I'm not going to interrupt the meeting and walk in. You know, it's already started 10 minutes ago. I don't want to be rude. I was just making an excuse. And so I came back 2 weeks later and I actually went into the room this last time and I sat in there and I watched it and I walked away. Everybody was very nice, very considerate, very encouraging and supportive. I just couldn't see myself standing up there, somebody asking me a question that I had no idea or prepared for, and having to stand there for 1 to 2 minutes and talk about whatever that question was. And I just couldn't see myself doing that. And that was a fear that I had to overcome. And I left and I didn't go back. Well, 2 years later, I found myself walking through education center, and I saw a flyer that said Toastmasters on the wall. And I ended up, you know, going to, I said, now's now or never. You know, you're about to launch your coaching business for good. This is what you're going to do. You need to develop these personal speaking skills, and it's now or never, do or die. And that's what I told myself. And so I went to the first meeting. I just, you know, did very, very well for my first icebreaker. I was very well prepared. And then for the next, I don't know, 6 months, all I did was table topics, which is just impromptu speaking. And I didn't really dive too much more into the material or the modules that they had designed for your education. And I was just, like I said, doing the impromptu speaking. Well, then a gentleman named Joe V. Hill came along, and there was a speaking contest coming up for impromptu speaking. And he encouraged me. He's like, "Hey, you're the one of the longest or oldest members here. You've been here for a while." He's like, "It's your turn. You're up in the chute." He goes, I think you should go do it." And I was like, "Nah, I don't want to do it." But nobody else from our club wanted to go. And I was like, "Well, you know what? Since nobody wants to go from the club, I'll just represent the club, good, bad, or indifferent. I'll learn something from the experience. I don't expect to do too much because I've only been a Toastmaster for 6 months." And so I went, and I ended up winning first place in that speaking contest. And I was terrified. I was actually in the bathroom, in the mirror, doing power poses and speaking to myself motivationally just to try and pump myself up for that first speech contest. I was terrified. I was sweating. My armpits were wet. I mean, it was bad. It was really, really bad. And I walked away very, very happy, and then I went to the division contest, and I ended up winning the division contest. And then I went to the district contest, and they asked me a question that I couldn't do. And they asked me to tell a joke, that the first joke that I'd ever committed to memory. And I had no joke for them. I never kept a joke in my back pocket. And for 1 to 2 minutes, I stood up there, and I told them why I didn't have a joke, even though that was the question, was to tell us that joke. And I told him I was a very direct, driven, demanding person. I explained a little bit about my childhood and how I grew up and how I was a very serious person because, you know, growing up without a father figure, I always thought I had to compete and fight harder than everybody else did. And so I didn't have time to play or tell jokes. And I'd heard some very bad off-color jokes when I was a child, and I just didn't like, you know, that kind of comedy. And, you know, obviously I watch sitcoms on TV and I laugh and I go to comedy shows now. I just don't tell a lot of jokes. And so I walked off the stage and I was very, very upset about my performance. And I was actually red in the face and I was like, man, I let my club down. I let myself down. I looked like a fool. I was getting down on myself. And then after the thing was over and they announced the winner, we had dinner that evening and everybody came up to my table. Almost everybody in that room, there's probably like 200 or 300 people, but almost, I mean, I shook so many hands and so many people talked to me. It felt like the entire room. And they said, "I am so proud of you. That was the most courageous thing I've ever seen anybody do." They were like, if I was on that stage and they asked me to tell a joke, I would have just sat there in silence. I cannot believe you came up with something to talk about and made the time and actually didn't flop. They were like, that was so impressive. And I walked away from there going, oh, my goodness, what just happened? I thought I was horrible. And these people were like, thought I was like the best thing that was out there. Even though I didn't win the contest because I didn't answer the question, I was disqualified. I still made the valiant effort. And I mean, then I just went back to Toastmasters after that. And I finished all my education awards and earned a triple crown that year. So,
wow. And what is a triple crown?
So basically, a triple crown is where you earn education awards. So there's two different tracks back then. Now they have this program called Pathways. But when I first joined Toastmasters, there was a leadership track and then there was a speaking track. And so I had earned two leadership track education awards. And then I also earned a public speaking communication education award. And basically, there's certain requirements that you have to fulfill. You have to serve on a committee and boards. You have to do certain projects. You have to give 10 speeches. You have to give certain presentations. And so you just follow. It's an education system is what it is. And I'd earned three of those awards. And many people, they take 5 to 10 years just to get their Distinguished Toastmaster. And so they may only earn one education award every 1 to 2 years. And so, and they give special awards for people who earn 3 in a year.
Mm. Sounds like you were a bad man in a good way.
Yeah, well, I worked hard. So that, I mean, once I came off that stage after that failure that I thought I had that was actually turned around on me and flipped, I was really, really motivated. And I realized that I did have the strength to do this and I did have the potential. And that kind of gets to me where I tell a lot of people that I see and I engage with, even though they look down upon themselves for their certain performances, I tell them, I was like, you're just like me when I was younger. I didn't feel like I had what it took. You know, I didn't think, you know, that I was capable of doing this, but you are. Every single one of us are. And we do have what it takes and we are good enough. And I was like, until you believe that, you're not going to exceed, you're not going to excel at the level that you really want to, that you desire. You have to start believing in yourself. And I was like, that's the lesson that I had to learn a second time when I was older, when I was going through Toastmasters, is that I just didn't think I had what it took. And when I realized it, when I was put on the spot to do that, I actually showed up and shined and realized that, hey, you know, even though it wasn't the greatest performance, it inspired other people.
Wow. So why do you believe, this is retrospectively looking back, why do you believe you were afraid to speak? Or, you know, you said you were sweating the first time you did it and you were really nervous at something you were great at doing.
Yeah, you know, I just always, it was the thought of public speaking, you know, it's the number one fear in the world. People would rather face death than do public speaking. The statistics don't lie. I mean, like, literally, that's the way it is. And it's amazing to me that how many people are afraid to stand up in front of a group of people and talk. Like, if you just get up and somebody asks you, say, tell 3 things about you, people will start freaking out at a boardroom if you're the new person, right? They do. They're just, you're getting really nervous. Like, oh, what am I going to say? People are going to judge me. Nobody wants to judge you. People want to hear you say something fantastic and they want to connect with you. And we tell ourselves that nobody's going to like me. And when actually people are looking for a reason to like you, you just have to share yourself. And I think that's what it was for me, because when they told me how to do a public speaking class in high school, I hated it. Public speaking was the last class I took when I was in college. I had done all my schoolwork, and the only graduation requirement I had left was public speaking. I procrastinated on that one till the very end. And I was fine. I just kept telling myself that I'm not any good at this. I don't like being up in front of people, and I just never found my passion. But once I found the type of public speaking that I wanted to do and what I actually wanted to talk about, that it just, I'm good now. I mean, it doesn't bother me. I mean, you get a little bit of nerves going into it, and you should. Because a little bit of nerve says to me that you really care about this and you're nervous about messing it up. And that's a good thing. But your nerves shouldn't control you. Your fear shouldn't shut you down. So,
great. So I know you're a podcaster as well. What's the name of your podcast?
So I have the True Success Podcast. And that's actually hosted also on anchor.fm. And I usually run a solo show about 2 days a week on Mondays and Fridays. And then I try to do interviews on Wednesdays. And sometimes I'll do a Q&A for people that want to send in a question or two and want me to answer those on the air. So
what types of things do you talk about?
So we talk about the build, grow, and create. And it's helping people go from to a purpose-driven leader to an impact leader, and it's taking you through that journey. And that's what we like to talk about, is how to create that ripple effect, right? And when you look at the acronym ripple effect, or create a ripple effect, it stands for care. And that's what care is create a ripple effect. And it's caring for people in such a way that it resonates through generations and through people.
So what, have you written any books yet?
I'm in the process of actually writing 2, one about my journey in life. And then the other one is on leadership. And it really goes back down to what I talked about earlier in your podcast, was values, strengths, vision, mission, and goal setting.
So what's the best way for people to contact you for your services?
Yeah. So the best way to contact me is to go to KirbyEngels.com. And there you'll see all the social media buttons and my email address and how to, you know, reach me on the homepage.
So what's your one to grow on? Meaning, what valuable piece of information would you like to leave our audience with?
Yeah, the most valuable piece of information I would love to leave the audience is that if you don't believe in yourself, then it's not going to happen. And you have to start believing. You start to have faith. And you have to start recognizing all the signs that, you know, there's breadcrumbs that have been left for us over time. You know, you could look back at your life and you could say, well, I did this well and I did that well. And I was, people said I did good at this. And you just need to follow those breadcrumbs and believe that you have what it takes and that you are good enough. And it's whatever you set your mind to and what you tell yourself, that's what you're going to become. And so you just, it's really, it boils down to just believing, and everything else will start to take, you know, shape on its own. You just have to show up and believe in yourself.
Thank you for listening to the New Mind Creator podcast with your host, Maurice, the New Mind Creator. This podcast has been sponsored by Abundant Sports and True Serum. Head over to www.mauriceflournoy.com to receive more motivation and insight to help create your new mind.